This is a podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn.
And we start with a very simple question, and that is, how often do you see your GP? Is it only when you are sick? Or do you like to be proactive about your health? An ounce of prevention, they say, is better than a dose of cure. You may not want to walk into the surgery, though, and tell your doctor that there's nothing wrong. Instead, you might want to schedule some routine tests. But what should those tests be? That's what we're talking about on our talking point this morning. What you need to know about your health as you get older, every 10 years or so. And Dr. Vivian Miller is our very special guest. Dr. Miller, good morning. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Rod. Hi, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, everyone.
Yes, so let's hope. Now, we will urge people, feel free to call if there's some medical issue that you'd like to discuss, or you've got a question, then please call 1-300-800-222. I will say, of course, that we're not here to solve people's medical problems. We can't issue prescriptions, but Dr. Miller can give general advice in your situation.
And I'm very happy to.
Yes. Let's start in your 20s or 30s. That's when people are generally at their healthiest, hopefully. If you feel, okay, I'm fine, I don't have anything wrong with me, but I'm going to go to the doctor, what should you be asking about?
Well, I think in your 20s and 30s, it's very easy to go to the doctor and discuss your family history. And I think one of the most underrated indicators of potential future health is your family history. Now, if, for example, you have a family history of hemochromatosis in a first-degree relative, that's an iron storage disease, it's one of the most common genetic conditions in our society, it will be wise to mention that to the doctor. If you have asthma, which is also extremely common, then you would be wise to discuss your asthma management with your doctor at least annually. And especially if you're having any outbreaks, people rely on Ventolin too much, they don't use preventers enough. For women, cervical screening and opportunistic sexually transmitted disease tests would be a good idea. And for men, of course, sexually transmitted disease tests as well. But the biggest thing I see in my practice is you give the advice to people about, say, iron deficiency that they've just been diagnosed with on the basis of heavy periods for women usually. Men are unlikely to get iron deficiency unless they're highly vegetarian or vegan. But the biggest problem I see is that you give the advice to people, take the iron supplements for 3 months and retest, they don't do it. And they turn up the next year and want another test, or the 6 months later they want another test, but they haven't had the treatment. And so you go around in this circle of people being iron deficient for years, or not using condoms and being at risk and wanting sexually transmitted disease tests every 4-3 months because they change partners, but they're not using condoms with each partner, and so they're putting themselves at risk of disease. So it's fair enough to advise testing, but the patient has to also take the responsibility for the treatment. You see it with asthma too. You know, you advise a preventer because they're regularly using their Ventolin. It's a dangerous situation to rely on Ventolin for asthma, because Ventolin does not prevent the underlying cause of asthma, which is swelling of the airways and narrowing of the airways due to the swelling. And that's what causes the constriction of the tube, so you can't breathe. You explain that to the patient, but for some reason, perhaps cost in some cases, because it's expensive if you're not a pensioner, they don't want to use the preventer. So as a GP, I can give the advice, but the patient needs to listen and actually follow through to get the best out of the situation.
As usual, the patient is the problem, Vivian.
No, not at all. The patient's not the problem at all, because it's a psychological thing.
Right.
And sometimes it's a cost thing, and sometimes
it's
a spur-of-the-moment thing, and sometimes it's an I-don't-know thing, or sometimes the patient...
But if you prescribe something to someone, you want them to take it.
Absolutely.
You can't take it for them.
And I write it down for people.
Yeah.
And I don't know what other GPs do, but it's useful to ask your GP to write down the instructions.
Yes.
Because your ability to remember what happens in the consultation is not easy unless you're a specialist in that area.
Okay. Just on family history, though, and how important that is, I have no idea, really. The the problems perhaps that my father had? Or, I mean, I could ask my mother. My father is long dead.
Ask your mother.
What sort of things are we talking about for people in their 20s? Let's start with them.
Well, for example, my family history, if you smoke, you die at 40. If you don't smoke, you die at 60. Now, that's relevant to someone who's 20 or 30 because the first thing you want to do is get your cholesterol tested because that's the underlying cause and look at other risk factors. High blood pressure in my family comes on in my 30s. You know, short-sightedness comes on in your late teens, and that's an important thing. People in their 20s will be wise to get their eyes checked, even though they're only 20s. You can still get eye problems in your 20s that you wouldn't expect to have that can show up late unless you get urgent treatment early. You know, there's a lot of things, dentistry, prevention with dentistry, but when it comes back to your family history, the most relevant things, I think people in their 20s and 30s should have a one-off cholesterol. If it's completely normal, really normal, then you don't really have to worry until you're in your 40s. But if it's not completely normal, and very occasionally it can be very high, you look at the family history and you say, is there a family history of early heart disease under the age of 65? You know, are people prone to high blood pressure or diabetes? And you look at those risk factors for heart disease too, because somebody in their 20s may be getting overweight, not exercising, they may smoke, and if they've got a family history of early heart disease, you can prolong their life by 20 years.
Okay, so cholesterol test, blood pressure test, your eyes, get your teeth, make sure they're okay, and find out about your family history. That's what you should be doing
absolutely.
In your 20s.
Sexually transmitted disease screen, any problems with fertility if you're interested in having babies, for women especially, fertility issues, they can sometimes run in families, and that you might want to be aware of those sorts of things because you don't want to leave children bearing till your 30s.
Now, one of our texters says, look, that's all very well. Maybe if you live in the city, if you live in a rural area, very difficult to see your local GP. What can they do?
Well, if you live in a rural area, take the opportunity when you are near a doctor to go and see one as part of the plan for when you're in a rural area, you're leaving the rural area. A lot of rural areas do have doctors, but it's true that they can be several hours away. And what a lot of patients do, because I've worked in rural areas extensively, what patients should do is when they are going out of that area into another area, obviously schedule an appointment with their doctor opportunistically.
Very difficult, though, sometimes to get into some of these medical centres because there's one doctor for thousands of people.
That's why you have to book ahead, because usually people have to book either airlines or usually they know several weeks ahead they're planning to go.
And this is, we should point out, at the moment we're talking about people perhaps in their 20s or 30s. We'll jump ahead, in fact, we'll come back to people's 40s in a second, but a couple of callers want to talk about something that happens a little bit later. And one of our texters, Jim, says, I'm 54 years old. Should I have a PSA test? Just explain what that is and whether Jim should have one.
That's a really good question. Now, PSA test stands for prostate-specific antigen, and that's a protein that's put out by the prostate gland into the blood and can be measured by a blood test. If you have a raised PSA, and there's certain guidelines for defining a raised PSA based on age, then depending on how high that is, it may be flagged for further investigation if it's very high, or for monitoring, which is usually either repeating 3 to 4 months or 6 months or perhaps a year annually, depending on how high it is and what the family history is. Once again, you see the relevance of a family history, because if you have a family history of prostate cancer in your father or your brother, your risk then goes right up to about, I can't remember the statistics actually at the top of my head. It's, what time is it now, 4 a.m.?
It's only 20 past two in Western Australia, Vivian. A lot earlier over there.
Just rest assured that you will not die of prostate cancer statistically if your father or brother has it, but you are at increased risk, and it is an identifiable disease and it is preventable. So my advice and the general advice for from the Urological Society of Australia is to have a PSA test if you're over 50 as a one-off and then every second year. But if you have a family history of prostate cancer, and especially if it's under 50, then you need to discuss that with your GP as well. And I need to point out here that there's a special group of people, and I really want this message to get out, so I'm so glad, Rod, that you gave me the opportunity to do this talk. There is a special group of people out in the community who may not be aware that they are at markedly increased risk of cancer and cancers earlier on, and there's a variety of syndromes and genetic things that can cause this. But if you have a family history of prostate cancer in a relative who's under 50, that could, if you have other family members on the same genetic side as that person, be an indicator for having one of those hereditary gene abnormalities. And people don't realise that. It's the same for breast cancer.
Yes.
If you're, you know, if you're under 45, there's a possibility that you could have a genetic type of cancer that could be passed on.
We'll get to that in a moment. But that, again, we reinforce that people should talk about. I mean, people
family
probably
history.
Tend not to talk about prostate cancer. And
Everything comes
people.
Back to
yes.
family history to me.
Yeah, indeed. All righty. Now, Jono's with us. Jono, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well. Now, Jono, you, I'm sure, have received the bowel cancer screening test in the mail. Everyone gets one once they turn 50, and then every couple of years after that, if not every year. We've seen ads on TV at the moment. There's billboards. They're online everywhere. This is a really strong public health initiative by the federal government. What questions have you got, Jono?
Well, I've actually got one from the government and one from my private health insurance, okay. And I have not used either.
Why not?
Why? That's why I was going to ask the doctor, and I know personally that I should, but I have this inhibition to do it. I'm not sure what it is. I want to know or don't want to know?
It's interesting, isn't it? It's interesting. That's what I was saying before about you can tell the patient to do something, but for some reason they don't. And I'd be interested to know what the inhibition is, because my guess is it's not just because of the nature of the test, which is unpleasant. Not as unpleasant as the ad campaign calling it poo, but it's still unpleasant to have to collect your own feces, but calling it poo is a step worse. Perhaps
well, that way that tells people what it is. A lot of people may not necessarily know.
Oh, dear.
Now, I will say, Jono, you are in the majority. In 2016-17, only 41% of people did this test and sent it off, and you get the result back within a week or two, generally. Is it? You're saying you don't want to know whether you've got bowel cancer?
No.
Why not?
No, it's not that. Well... I'm not adverse to finding out. I tell you that everybody wants to live.
Is it the colonoscopy?
It's the nature of my poop.
Right.
Okay.
What's the problem with that?
Well, I drink a lot of beer, so.
So you're loose.
Yes.
Well, it doesn't matter. I mean,
it's only a tiny bit. It's like the head of a pin.
They're not really interested in that.
Okay, well,
they're not judging on quality or quantity.
It's not a personal rating score, you know.
And they don't write back and say, hang on, we want you to do something better.
They don't publish it on the net.
Yeah.
It could save your life, John.
I wouldn't have. Exactly. And that's probably why I'm ringing you.
How much do you drink, by the way, Jono?
Yeah, more importantly.
How much, Jono? Well, I've been watching cricket all night, so I probably drank 16, 17 cans of beer.
Well, that's a bigger problem than doing the bowel cancer test to me, because your risk of bowel cancer goes right up because of the amount of alcohol that you drink, as does your risk of pancreatic cancer and stomach cancer, and also other issues like heart disease and brain disease, and, of course, liver disease everyone knows about. But the fact that you can do that and still talk on the radio... is a little bit of a concern to me, because you obviously do it regularly.
Yeah, they're not super strong.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, but it's 17 cans of beer, if it's not super strong. Are you talking about light beer or normal strength?
EMU Export.
Yeah, it's normal strength. It's not documented as alcohol light.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know how many standard drinks that is?
I'd say about 12.
No, if you had 17 beers, you can times it by 1.2. So it's more like 20, 21 or something, isn't it? standard drinks. But more importantly, what we're trying to say here is that that's something to discuss with your GP at any age. Nobody should be drinking more than, and this is not said judgmentally, this is said medically, nobody should be drinking more than four drinks in one night, four standard drinks, which is the equivalent of three beers at a party, because after that, the reason they have the ceiling level at that level is that it's defined as binge drinking after that, and you get damage to your brain over time, you get damage to your heart and liver. It sounds such a small amount, I know, especially in our society, but that's the reason why that amount has been chosen as the cutoff. And for some reason, that message is not getting out there. And honestly, I think it's because it's related to sport, and alcohol and sport go together. We're a sport-related society. It's all through our culture. It's the biggest health risk I can see in general practice for everyone, alcohol.
So I'm not alone.
Oh, God, no. But unfortunately, trying to convince people that they should really only have one standard drink a day, and on weekends maximum of four, and two alcohol-free a week, which is what the Australian Psychiatry College say, is just that people just laugh at you in general practice. You know, an alcoholic is defined as drinking more than one's doctor, but even so.
All right, Jono, good luck with that. Firstly,
but please, Jono, have the test. Have the test.
Do the that's one thing that at least you'll need on our bowel cancer.
And just one word for everyone out there. If you know that you bleed from the bowel, and especially if you haven't had that investigated, please don't do the test. Just go to your GP and get a colonoscopy, because that's what you need. The whole reason for doing the test is to see if you have blood in the motions. So, and you might not realise it. So if you do know that you have blood in the motions, you need to discuss that with the GP and go and get a colonoscopy.
Okay.
And, you know, if the GP thinks that it's wise, which if you're over 40, they probably will.
All right. To quote Red Simons, says one of our nurses listening, when else can you send your poo to the government and they say thank you? All right. Mick did the test. G'day, Mick.
G'day, how are you?
Hello.
Fine. What happened, Mick?
I just want to know how that bloke could be still talking and have 14 beers.
Man, 16, 17 beers.
Yeah, I know. I don't think I'd be awake. But
I'm struggling and I haven't had one.
I had a truck driver once that drank 22 beers, and I asked him where he got the time, and he said he drank while he drove.
Oh, please.
Lovely.
Okay. Yes. Mick, tell me about this bowel cancer test.
I had one of the bowel cancer tests come when I turned 50, the present from the government. But, they found a growth down in one of the tubes inside when they'd done the top half. And plus I had polyps, and they cut them out, but they found a growth in there that could have turned cancerous.
That's
but
absolutely right.
Luckily, I had the test and they found it. And it's
how old are you?
It was when I turned 50. It's like that present you get from the government.
Yes.
Wow. Well, I tell you what, that's unusual to get that sort of degree of problem at 50. So, again, it comes back to your family history. Is there any family history of bowel problems relating to cancer?
No, I don't think so. My mum and dad haven't.
No, okay, well, you know, there is now, because at 50, that's quite a young age to get that problem. The risk of you having changes like that and several polyps in addition puts your first-degree relatives at higher risk.
Yeah, well, I had an extra colonoscopy check. They cut it out, and then I've had another one last year, and everything's clear. So.
Good, excellent. But tell your children, you must tell your children that they should have colonoscopies from probably 42 onwards because of the risk for them. And often cancers these days, you see this over generations, that cancers come out in the next generation a bit sooner if they're hereditary cancers. And there is a type of bowel cancer where you get multiple polyps and cancers that occur in younger age groups, and they can come out in people as young as 42.
Right.
The polyps can, and of course then you can prevent them from going on to getting bowel cancer at 50.
Okay. All righty, Mick, good luck with that. Thank you very much. Don't want to just talk about bowel cancer tests. We've got plenty of other things to talk about.
Yeah.
Although Callum just wants to make one final comment on this. G'day, Callum.
Hi, how are we?
Hello.
Yes, good.
I just take you off speakerphone.
Yeah,
all right. I just thought I'd let you know that any bloke that doesn't get a test after 50 is mad. I've just turned 50, and I had a test done. I had a 1.5-centimetre polyp with what they call microns, which was about half the polyp of cancerous. So.
Well, you see, you're another one whose first-degree relatives will need to have colonoscopies much earlier.
Yeah.
You know, because of the risk of them having, and they may not have it, but their risk then becomes much higher. And if you have another family member who has had bowel cancer, is unlucky enough to, their risk becomes even higher still, perhaps 1 in 3 or 1 in 4.
Yeah.
So for
well,
your first degree relatives.
I had my first test done at 38 because I had bleeding of the bowels and it was through hemorrhoids and stuff.
Yeah.
So,
well,
yeah.
That's very clever of you. And, you know, unfortunately, people don't get it done. There's a theory in medicine which unfortunately in our country financially cannot be done, but overseas probably is in some places, where everybody age 60 should have a colonoscopy because bowel cancer is more common after 60.
Okay.
And it will sieve out the people that have the high risk polyps, which are the precursors to cancer, and that's what you had that was changing and what the other man had that was going to change. And if you sieve those people out at 60, where the most of them, you two were unlucky, you're more likely to have a stronger form of hereditary aspect to it. But people over 60 often just, you know, have bowel cancer, and their risk in their children is threefold rather than much higher.
Okay, all right.
But, you know, if you have changes then, you can go into a screening program for more regular colonoscopies, and that will save a lot of lives, but it's just not cost-effective in our society.
Mm.
So for that reason, the government's introduced the screening program they have. For God's sake, take advantage of it.
Yes, indeed. It's free. You might think, it's a little bit, you know, uncomfortable, perhaps. Yeah, or you might feel uncomfortable. It's not an uncomfortable thing to do, but, I mean, it's infinitely preferable to
having half your bowel removed.
That's right.
But most importantly, yeah. Again, if you do get bleeding, and especially, and or if you have a strong family history of bowel cancer in your family, one or more members, you need to discuss that with your GP. Don't go and have the test because you'll need a colonoscopy instead, especially for the bleeding issue.
Just on
or
that,
changing bowels.
By the way, we know about privacy rules and regulations, but if you go to the same doctor as other members of your family and they see that, you know, your brother, your uncle, your father, mother, whatever, has presented with a certain problem, should a doctor say to you, by the way, have you thought about this, or I'd like you to get checked for this?
Absolutely. But what isn't legal is without the other people's permission to tell the patient that that your relatives have had, several of your relatives have had bowel cancer, or your auntie, whatever, had something or other. You can't say that to a patient without the other person's permission. But I tell you, it does happen that people don't get on with their relatives,
yeah.
And you happen to have knowledge of that. And what you can do is just say, look, I really think you need a colonoscopy.
Mm.
And
okay.
You can speak. What I usually do is I ring up the specialist and ring up the specialist so it's not documented that I've broken confidentiality, and just let them know there's a strong family history and three relatives without saying who they are.
Okay.
So that, you know, nobody gets upset, but the information is still passed on. There's also a legal right for the patient to know about something hereditary like that as well. But the problem is you've got to get the problem before you can sue your relatives for it.
Oh,
so
dear.
The whole thing's a bit crazy. It's I think really ultimately you should do the best for everyone with keeping privacy.
Okay. One of our texters says, you are not alone in how much you drink, but Jono, you alone can treat yourself. Signed, One Who Knows. Another of our texters says, prostate cancer is not preventable. Maybe the doctor meant treatment is possible if identified. So is prostate cancer preventable or not?
Well, technically speaking, they're right. But the reason why, sir, I'm not sure I used the word preventable, actually.
Yeah.
I don't think I did.
Yeah.
I think they may have read that somewhere else. You'd have to go back and listen to the recording. But if I did say it was preventable, what I mean is that the advanced cancer is preventable. So there's a big difference between having your entire prostate cut out, having radiotherapy, and then being put on Zoladex. There's a big treatment between that and just having the prostate cancer cut out and being monitored.
Okay.
So in that respect, early treatment results in a massive change in management.
Okay.
And it may not
yes.
result in treatment at all in some cases. We just watch it.
David is next. Hello, David.
Good morning, Rod.
Good morning. You want to talk about something specific? What is that?
Yes, it is. Well, Doctor, I have some peripheral neuropathy, and I could put Booney to shame at one point. And I'm wondering if this neuropathy is reversible.
Okay, you might want to explain what that is, Doctor.
Yeah. Look, there's different sorts of peripheral neuropathy. Have you got a sensory peripheral neuropathy? Oh, God help me, the morning. I've not been drinking anyone. your peripheral neuropathy, is it sensory or motor or both?
Okay, it's sensory. It feels like I'm walking on sponge.
Okay, so what's happened is the nerves that go down your legs have started to malfunction, and the malfunction starts typically in peripheral neuropathy at the end of the nerves and works their way up. So over time, the problem spreads further up the foot and then sometimes up the leg. Sometimes it stops, sometimes it doesn't, and it gets worse. And the cause should be identified wherever possible, but sometimes there is no cause identifiable, and we call that idiopathic. And
okay,
so,
So
the commonest cause in our society is diabetes.
Right.
Does that mean that eventually people are concerned about having to have an amputation?
Well, the problem with peripheral neuropathy is that if you can't feel things, there's two pieces of advice that are crucial for you. The first is never go without shoes, because you can't feel if you're treading on something like a splinter of glass or something that goes into your foot. And the second...
I would feel that. I mean, I have some sense of touch down there. You know, the nerve endings are completely killed. I'm not...
If you feel as if you're walking on cotton wool, I can guarantee you that although your nerves are not completely killed, you may miss that, because I've got the same problem on one foot from nerve damage, and I miss it too. And I don't feel as if I'm walking on cotton wool.
All right. So
that's the first bit of advice. Even though you think that you would feel it, you must wear shoes all the time. Don't get barefoot, even in the house. And the second piece of advice, which is crucial, is that you need to look at your feet every night to make sure that there's no chafing, there's no rubbing, blisters, ulcers developing, because you may not be able to feel those until, or infections, you may not be able to feel or see those until they're very marked if you don't look.
Okay. All right. So, again, I will emphasise that we're not here.
Well, yeah, you need to see the doctor about the causes.
Miller is not here to give specific advice, but general advice, certainly. Jimmy in Cairns is next. Hello, Jimmy. Hang on a minute. Sorry, Jimmy, good morning.
Good morning. How are we?
Good morning. How are you, though?
Look, I'm not too bad. I think I was diagnosed with diabetic cellulitis probably 5 years
ago. What was that?
I was
diagnosed with diverticulitis.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with diverticulitis 5 years ago. And 5 months ago, I had my sigmoid bowel removed.
Oh, dear.
They found a muscle cyst, and which came back, everything was fine.
Not a great phone line. I'm sorry, Jimmy. We'll try and get you back on a better line there. I'm sorry, but... they found something in a follow-up test. But again, we'll talk to Jimmy in a second and hopefully...
sounds like he needs regular colonoscopies again.
Okay. Malcolm says, are hemorrhoids indicative of polyps or bowel cancer?
Absolutely not. Okay. Hemorrhoids are basically where you're getting parts of the venous cushion around the anus being pushed out when you open your bowels because of the pressure. Okay. And what's happening is the skin is... falling through in between the muscle layers of the anal region, and the veins are also falling through after the skin. So when you see a lump there after you open your bowels, the first thing you need to do after wiping yourself and having a quick shower is to lie down and push them back in. If you don't feel comfortable doing that, you can put some plastic over your fingers, but push them back in and lie down for 10 minutes. And if you do that, then the hemorrhoid will not swell and continue to cause problems. It will appear to go away, but of course, in many cases, the next time you open your bowels, it can go back again.
What about having a B-day or something like that? Would that help?
Oh, yeah, the Europeans love bidets. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the reason for bidets and the reason why I say go and have a quick shower is because it's hygienic after you open your bowels, if possible.
Eddie says, how often should someone be checked after the removal of a tubular adenoma?
Basically, a tubular adenoma puts you at increased risk of bowel cancer, but it depends on the size of the adenoma. There's different types of adenomas. A tubular adenoma is not as bad as some of the other ones.
I'm not even sure what it is. You might explain.
Yeah, what it is it's a polyp, a type of polyp, a growth in the bowel. And there's different sorts of adenomas, different sorts of growths in the bowel. Adenoma by itself is harmless. It's not bowel cancer, but it indicates that you have a tendency to polyp development. And you'd be guided by your specialist in that setting because obviously you've had a colonoscopy as to how often to have another. Usually it's every 5 years.
All right. And one other text before we go back to calls. Where do I go for a pap smear test if I'm too uncomfortable for my GP to do it?
Well, a lot of people don't want to have intimate examinations by their GP. In that case, you can either find another GP in the local area by word of mouth with your girlfriends, or you can that's usually the best option.
I mean, can you go to a hospital?
You'd have to discuss that with your GP, so it all comes down to being examined anyway. So,
except you don't want to go to your GP to say, by the way, I'm uncomfortable with you doing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So, normally the clinics don't do them anyway. It's not the job of a clinic to do a pap smear unless somebody has very difficult examination. For example, they had previous surgery for abnormalities and that sort of situation. So best option is to find a GP by word of mouth that you're comfortable with. There is also the possibility that you can do what's called self-collection, because now they've changed the pap smears to what's called a cervical screening program. That happened about 18 months ago. And what they do now is they test the cervix cells for human papillomavirus, which is always sexually transmitted. And depending on the type of human papillomavirus, there's a different risk of cancer of the cervix developing in the future. So I must emphasise, a pap smear is not a test for cancer. It's a test for changes that you get long before you get cancer.
Right.
And so if you remove the cells, if they persist, if you remove them, especially if they're high risk, then and monitor to make sure that the changes don't recur, then you prevent cervical cancer. So there is the possibility that you can have what's called self-collection if you're really, really embarrassed. And you can discuss that with your GP as well. And there's techniques that need to be explained to you for that.
They reckon that HPV will be eliminated in Australia by 2028. Do you think that's likely?
Yeah, I think that's an absolute misquote. Okay, I mean, I can't imagine how that's going to happen, because there are people out there who don't vaccinate their kids. The vaccination occurs at teenage years, and it's very common to miss those vaccines. The very groups of people, for example, your friend in the country that rang in, those people may have more difficult access to vaccinations. There's all sorts of reasons why it's never going to be completely eradicated, and you still need to have cervical screening, even if you've had the human papillomavirus vaccination. But most importantly, there's going to be people out there, especially overseas people who may have not had it.
Okay.
So I'll never get it completely eradicated, that I can see by 2028.
Alex in Perth says, my grandmother died of an aneurysm. My father's uncle died of an aneurysm, and my dad had an aneurysm in his lower stomach just over 12 months ago, and he nearly died, and he still has one next to his heart. Should I get checked out? We don't know how old Alex is.
I don't know where the other aneurysm... It doesn't matter how old he is, actually, paradoxically. I don't know where the other aneurysms occurred, but if they're aneurysms in the brain, they often rupture. Sometimes they don't, but they often do. There's a 10% chance that they will rupture in your lifetime if you have an aneurysm in the brain. One in 200 people will have this problem, and an aneurysm is a dilation of the blood vessel, an abnormal dilation. And, of course, if you have an abnormal dilation of blood vessel, there's a possibility that that area can weaken over time and eventually rupture, and that causes a stroke. It causes a particular type of stroke caused by hemorrhage, and it can be hereditary. In fact, 1 in 200 people will have that, but only 1 in 1,000 people will actually have a bleed from that. So having the problem doesn't mean that you have the stroke, But if you've got many members in your family that have that, it's strongly, strongly advised that you have an MRI scan of your brain every 5 years, because you need to know if you're developing an aneurysm of the brain.
Okay.
And unfortunately, that is not Medicare funded unless you get headaches for investigation. It's absolutely crazy.
Well, go to your doctor and say you're getting headaches.
Exactly. I shouldn't say that.
No, I shall.
Thank you.
Many GP clinics have nurses who do pap smears, says one of our Texas GP nurses.
We call them cervical screening now, yes.
Very skilled at this. Angela is next. Hello, Angela.
Oh, good morning. Doctor, it's usually around every 15 days, since April the 4th, I get facial swelling. It's either my top lip and right lip and jowl, or it's my left bottom lip, or it just rotates between either top or bottom lip and the jowl on the same side of the face. Now, I've been to doctor, dentist, endodontist, periodontist, facial cranio specialist, allergy specialist, and they're all a little lost. But I can predict every 15 days it starts maybe at about 7 o'clock, and by about 1 o'clock in the morning it looked like I've had a bad Hollywood lip job.
How strange.
Does it affect your tongue at all?
No.
Okay,
no.
So what you've got is what's called, it's diagnosable, it's idiopathic angioedema.
Why have the other people been unable to tell Angela that?
They have said it could be angioedema, but they say it's an allergic. Now, they took me off all medication, but if nothing makes any difference. At the moment, I'm taking 2 antihistamines every day to try and stem the... But
say again, this advice is of a general nature, and of course you must see your own doctor.
Yeah.
But Vivian, have you encountered this?
Oh, yes, I have. It's not that common, though. The usual causes for it, if you're looking at medications, are a group of antihypertensive medications called ACE inhibitors.
Yeah.
But if you're not on that...
I was, but they took me off, and it didn't make any difference. I'm still getting it every 15 days.
Well,
she's put me back
on those ever again.
She's put me back on them.
Sorry?
She's put me back on them, the same medication,
just on a slower dose.
Okay, I think, I'm going to urge you to talk to your own doctor about
that. Again with her.
But, okay.
But, because that's a well-known cause. But you can get it for no reason as well, in which case it
can
be very difficult to manage.
Does it just go away the way that
sometimes
it appears?
You can get batches of it, but yeah, they're right. It's got an immune allergic type aspect to it. But I, as I say, if you're on an obvious medication that can cause it, I think it might be wise to change to a different medication. That's just my opinion.
All righty, Angela. Good luck with that. That's terrible, though, doesn't it? Jimmy is back, hopefully. Good morning, Jimmy.
Morning, guys. Any better?
Slightly better. Slightly better.
Are you sick, Rod?
Yeah. Okay, so just going back to what I was, been suffering diverticulitis for about 5 years, and then after numerous colonoscopies and everything, they decided to do surgery and remove my sigmoid bowel. They found a cyst in while they were doing surgery, which is probably the size of an orange.
A cyst?
Yes.
Okay.
Which is attached to the ball, the bladder and the bowel, they remove that as well.
Is it part of a diverticular cyst? You know, the little outpouches of the bowel that get infected and therefore you can cause a lump of, pus and everything?
Yes.
That's what it was?
Yep.
Okay.
So I've had the surgery and everything now, so it's been 4 months now I've had surgery. I've still got a little bit of pain from the wounds and all that, and a bit of numbness where the major... wound is. But just want to know about follow-up colonoscopies and stuff like that. Do I keep...
Need to speak to your own
doctor
about that,
I think your
Jimmy.
Own doctor.
I'm sorry but to have
I
to
must
say.
Emphasise, diverticular disease is not the same as cancer of the bowel, and it doesn't, or polyps of the bowel, and it doesn't carry an increased risk of cancer. What it is it's like little hernias. It behaves like appendicitis, except that the little hernia sacs are not naturally there, unlike the appendix that can get blocked.
All righty. Let's talk to Liz on the Gold Coast. Hello, Liz.
Hi. I have a bit of a... Oh, gosh, there's an echo on the line. I have a bit of a problem I've been trying to figure out for a few years. I haven't asked my doctor only because it doesn't occur to me at the time.
I think you need to talk to your own doctor about it, though, Liz.
Yeah, I just wanted a general
sure,
question,
okay,
general answer. My now ex, I found out, was playing around, and I contracted chlamydia from him. Does that make me prone to cervical cancer?
Okay.
No. Chlamydia is not anything to do with cervical cancer. It's highly treatable. And don't forget to have a retest in 4 weeks after treatment. No sooner than 4 weeks, because the test can remain positive for 4 weeks. But you do need to be retested. A lot of people don't bother to get retested. But there's a 1 in 20 chance that the chlamydia has not been eradicated with treatment. That's why you have to have the retest. However, whenever you sleep with anybody in a major city around the world, you have exposed yourself to some form of sexually transmitted human papillomavirus. Now, most forms do not carry an increased risk of changes in the cervix. There's about 60 forms that can affect the genital region. But you don't know what sort you've been exposed to, because we don't normally test for them. And up until 18 months ago, we weren't routinely testing for human papillomavirus on pap smears. So what this means for you is that you must make sure that you do have regular pap smears, regular cervical screening, as they call it now.
All right, Liz, good luck with that. That sounds like a terrible
situation. I'm sorry for you, Liz. It's awful, it's very upsetting.
It? Yes, it is. Is that unprotected sex you're talking about, Doctor?
It would have to be, because to contract chlamydia, you have to have some form of intimate contact with the genitals.
Okay, all right. By the way, Alex in Perth, who talked about his aneurysm, or his family history, he says, I'm 28, and the funny thing is, I don't think it sounds too funny, I've been suffering from headaches that can last up to a week.
That's marvellous news, because then you get a rebate on your MRI scan, okay. And if you haven't had one, you need one, by the sounds of it. Having said that, aneurysms in the heart region and aneurysms in other places in the body is associated, and also in the brain, which I assume at least one of your relatives may have had by the sounds of it, is associated with certain syndromes. And I strongly suggest that you discuss that with your doctor, because those syndromes need to be identified. They can be associated with aneurysms and other things too. And I don't know if you have that, but you do need to discuss the types of aneurysms with your doctor and ask for a referral to a genetic specialist, because it sounds like you need one. To be fully informed about what other things you might be at risk for.
Okay. Look, we were talking before about, being unable to feel when you're walking and all that sort of thing. I mean, this is one of the things that people are concerned about with diabetes, for example.
Yes.
It's a terrible problem in society all over the world, but certainly in Australia. There's a lot of undiagnosed diabetes as well.
Yes.
But we often hear about people dying from complications from diabetes. So how do those complications occur?
That's a very good question. There's textbooks written on it. There's whole societies that discuss this. I edited Diabetes Management Journal for about 8 years, and I'm involved with endocrinology today. Basically, diabetes is a very, very deceptive disease. It's deceptive because the damage gets done over years. So if you don't know that you have diabetes, you have robbed yourself of the chance to control it optimally and reduce the risk of complications. Even with ideal control, diabetes can still cause complications, but they come on much, much later, and some cases not at all, because you're lucky enough not to get them.
When you say control, you mean what, medication and through modification of lifestyle?
Almost always medication should be used for diabetes, almost always. And the usual medication that's trialled first is metformin, and that's the one that you use for patients that have the stage before diabetes as well. If you can't tolerate metformin, it's possible you might not need medication, and you can control it with diet, exercise and weight loss. And I should emphasise that in 30 years of being a GP, I have seen 4 patients reverse their diabetes through lifestyle and exercise.
Hang on, when you say reverse, that's hugely controversial, because...
No, it's not at all. It's not controversial at all.
Some people say you cannot reverse it.
You absolutely can. You absolutely can, because think of it this way. If you weigh 100 kilos and you've got a sedentary job and you don't really watch your diet much and you have diabetes, and I say to you, look, you're a marvellous manager of your company, but you're not managing yourself, and you take up that challenge and you ask what you can do about it, and I put you on metformin and give you instructions to go and see a diabetes educator, a dietitian, start exercise program that's appropriate for you, and you take it all really seriously, you cut out the alcohol, you decrease the food intake, and you lose 30 kilos,
your diabetes goes completely.
So that it does, it never comes back?
If you maintain that lifestyle, you still have an increased risk of diabetes much later in life. But if this, especially if there's no family history of diabetes, then, and we're talking about type 2 diabetes here, I must emphasise that, not the type that involves insulin early, but the type that may involve insulin after 10 or 20 years. The majority of the population have type 2. This is the one we're talking about. If you do that, you don't have diabetes. If you maintain that lifestyle, your risk of getting diabetes back is so much lower. It's much less than the general population, and you don't have diabetes at the time.
So could I just ask about the definition then? Is it merely what your blood sugar level is?
Yes.
So basically, that if it goes back to normal or below normal, that is now not considered diabetic?
Yes, that's true. But
do you then continue to take the medication?
That's the more interesting aspect is, can you come off the metformin? Because that's the one that's used for stages where the blood sugar is abnormal, but not abnormal enough to diagnose diabetes. But there's another group of patients, for example, that are really well controlled on diet and exercise, and they go back to a blood glucose level because they've changed their lifestyle of not having diabetes. But I worry a bit more about that group if they haven't had massive weight loss, because their diabetes is not necessarily associated with, you know, the reversal of their diabetes is associated more with lifestyle changes but not weight loss. If you're massively overweight and you lose the weight, that's going to cure your diabetes quicker than anything else. But the people that don't lose the weight and still have excellent control and go back to levels that are pre-diabetic, I would not call that cure of diabetes. I would be more worried about that persisting, you know, and becoming more unstable with time. The ones that lose their weight and have no changes at all in their blood glucose, completely normal, on no medication, just because of their lifestyle change and massive weight loss, if they put the weight back on, they are going to get diabetic. If they're in their 40s or 50s, there's still a chance they'll get diabetic later on in life, yes, because they've obviously got that genetic tendency. But essentially, they are non-diabetic, you know, while they're like that.
Okay. We can talk about that at a later date, I think.
Very, very important conversation to have. But as I say, you know, 30 years, I've had 4 patients that have done it. It's frightening to see that 4 patients... In 30 years, it's what is stopping everybody from dropping weight? Because weight, being overweight, is the commonest cause of diabetes in our society. Some people will get diabetes and they're not overweight, and usually they're in their 60s or 70s and they've got a family history of it, and they don't drink too much, and you know they're not overweight. It's not that. That's a genetic type. You know, it's common. But to be overweight is the major risk factor in our society and sedentary behaviour.
We will talk about that perhaps next time we speak. Dr. Vivian Miller, I really appreciate the fact that you can give us your time, especially as you are so busy and it's so early in the morning for you, and I appreciate it very much, and thank you very, very much.
Thank you so much, and thanks for giving me the chance to just emphasise, you know, the two things in summary. Please watch your alcohol intake and your weight, and make sure you exercise and, you know, follow doctor's instructions. And the second thing is, if you do have access to your family history, it's really useful, because the vast majority of stuff we've discussed today, you know, if you ask, can be seen in family histories.
All right.
At an increased incidence.
Dr. Miller, thanks very much.
Thank you.
And that was another podcast from ABC Radio Overnights. I'm Rod Quinn. Thanks for listening.